On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. America's legal profession is based on ideals, on standards of education and admission to the practice, on ethics regulation, on a disregard for commercialism, and on working on behalf of the public good. The legal system is rooted in the belief that all should have access to justice. But my guest today, a Yale law professor and legal historian, says it's not so. The profession is hardly professional anymore. He says lawyers today are out for their own economic self-interest. They're beholden to the needs of clients, firms, and corporations. Up next, On Point, America's legal profession and whether or not it's a sellout. Joining me now from Stanford, California, is Robert W. Gordon. He's a professor of law and legal history at Yale Law School, and he's on sabbatical this semester at Stanford University. His article, Money, Power, Ambition Gone Awry, appeared in Legal Affairs magazine and will be included as a chapter in the forthcoming compilation, The Cambridge History of Law in America. Nice to have you, Professor. Thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you, Jane. I'm very happy to be here.
So the American lawyer, morally bankrupt, thinking more about billable hours than public service, is that the picture you're painting?
It's part of the picture, yes. The picture is a little more complicated because I think you have a whole other groups of the legal profession today who are engaged in public service work and public interest work as a kind of specialized branch of the profession. But the tradition in the profession has been that the leaders of the profession, the people at the very top, who today would be the major partners in major corporate law firms, also supplied the public leadership, the cadres for the republic. And this was true from the founding onward. Lawyers wrote the petitions and pamphlets that argued the case for revolution. They drafted the state and federal constitutions. They dominated public life, elective and appointive offices of state, dominated civic and political leadership, the reform movements for most of our history.
So why don't they do that now? Why don't the partners, these legal leaders, support these sort of lesser organizations, if you will?
Well, some of them, of course, still do. You still have activism in these causes, but it tends now more to be a part-time pro bono sort of thing. And the reason, I think, is simply that, you know, lawyers have worried for over two centuries whether their profession was becoming a business, whether its engagements on behalf of private clients were overwhelming its sense of public duties. And I think the answer is that law's always been both a business and a profession. But the pressures towards complete privatization of the profession, they were always present. But now it seems finally to have happened. The private practice of law is seen by its elites simply one of several technical service occupations, financial service occupations. And I think the public regarding view of the lawyer's role has been submerged in its private engagements. And I think this is less a moral decline than a change in the economics of the profession. It's become so intensely competitive. The competitive drive for profits is now so fierce that it takes time and attention away from practically everything else.
So really, it's all about money. Bottom line, it comes down to money and making more of it.
I'm afraid it does. The if you look at the major magazines and journals, for example, the profession, like the American Lawyer, the National Law Journal, you find that they rank firms in order of profits per partner. To be a successful firm, you have to generate profits per partner. If you don't, if you can't attract clients, you can't attract lawyers to your firm. You have to compete in beauty contests for corporate clients. You have to compete for partners. You have to compete for new associates. Everybody has to be paid enormous salaries, and in order to justify those salaries, they have to work 60, 70, 80, 90, 100-hour weeks.
And, well, you talk about that, the pathologies of the American law firms, these huge salaries at the top and the associates literally working around the clock, right? It's not getting any better. In fact, it's getting worse.
It's getting worse. Yeah, I think it's clearly getting worse. We're getting trapped in this in this seriously vicious cycle in which, in order to attract people to more and more unattractive work, we have to pay them more and more, and in order to justify and to pay their salaries or a share of profits, we have to work them harder and harder.
And more money isn't necessarily leading to greater happiness. You write in this piece about your own experience at your 25th reunion of the Harvard Law School. What happened?
Oh, yeah, that was really rather alarming. I mean, most of my classmates were until recently. I say that because partners are increasingly retired now, and they're involuntarily retired, usually in their mid-50s, in order to make room for younger people coming to the top. But most of my classmates who were partners in the country's major law firms were really miserable in their personal lives. They felt that they had exhausted themselves in lives which were in many ways professionally satisfying because they were technically very competent people, good legal craftsmen who'd done good work on behalf of clients, but they felt that they had not had time left over for public engagements, for family life, for friendships, for the kinds of things that for most of us make life worth living.
Not too many years ago, one out of five associates in any particular law firm made partner. Now in the big firms with thousands of lawyers, your chances are, what, one in 10, maybe one in 50? And how does that affect the profession and the individual lawyers?
Well, it's bound to affect it, of course. In some ways, the fact that it's now so hard to make partner is not a bad thing because associates don't now come into firms with unrealistic expectations, which are later disappointed. They know they're not going to stay, most of them. But this leads to a kind of cynicism and disaffection. If you're not really going to have ties to the organization, it can't demand loyalty from you, and you can't expect loyalty from it. It's really a short-term commercial bargain. You give all your efforts for a short time in exchange for money, and then if you're lucky, you pay off some of your law school debt and move on to something else.
In your article, you say being a competent lawyer these days isn't enough. You have to be a salesperson too, and that the law has gotten more specialized, more time-consuming. What happened? Why has that happened?
I think this is a function of intensified competition, and also the greater sophistication of the market for legal services. Law of all kinds has become more intricate, more technical, more specialized. The lawyers are no longer generalists who can range across a wide variety of legal specialties. You really have to some lawyers spend their entire lives mastering four or five sections of the tax code on behalf of their clientele.
How fun is that?
It must be said that some people love this life
and absolutely
and flourish in it these are the people, generally speaking, who stay with it and who rise to the top of firms. They have people of enormous energy and enormous appetite. But the thing is that being a specialist isn't enough. As you were saying, you have to be a salesman. You have to be a hustler. The big rewards in these firms go to the people who are rainmakers, who can bring in business, who can bring in a client book, so that you have to have those salesman's qualities. And many highly competent lawyers just don't have them. They're terrific specialists, securities lawyers or tax lawyers or banking lawyers, but they don't have the salesman's gift.
And in the world of globalization, Robert Gordon, how are American lawyers affecting global economies, and in turn, how then is it affecting them?
Well, American law practice and American lawyers are having a profound transformative effect on global law practice generally. There are actually some competing models. In Europe, the giant accounting firms are doing most of the kinds of jobs that American lawyers do, and there are European styles of lawyering which compete all over the world with American ones. But
in what way?
we've been very successful at exporting some distinctive American styles of practice, some of which I think are pretty good and others of which are pretty bad. The relatively good ones are the American model of the business transactional lawyer. This is the lawyer who doesn't just tell his clients what the law is, but he also figures out what the client's business plan is and advises the client what the legal, what the best legal means are to implement that plan. That,
a more well-rounded approach.
A more well-rounded approach and more and more concrete and more pragmatic. That seems to me actually one of the great strengths of American, of the American style of practice. Not such a great strength, it seems to me, is the American model of litigation. It's enormously expensive, just enormously time-consuming. The administrative and costs of engaging in litigation in this country, with its mountains of documents in discovery and the years and years of delay, is just a crushing burden. Almost nobody can afford to do it. Really, only the wealthiest clients and corporations can
afford to engage in this game. What the founding fathers or how the legal profession was based on, was it?
No, it really was not. I mean, in the early decades of the Republic, the lawyers tended, the successful lawyers, as today, the represented the wealthy commercial clients, banking and industrial and manufacturing and mercantile interests. But they also represented a wide variety of individual clients. And, of course, they spent at least half their careers in public office or in public engagements of one kind or another.
I'm joined from Stanford, California, by Robert W. Gordon. He's a professor of law and legal history at Yale Law School. His chapter, The Legal Profession, will be published in the forthcoming compilation, The Cambridge History of Law in America. I'd like to now bring in another voice into the conversation. Mark Agras joins us from Washington, D.C. He's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He was chair of the Commission on the Renaissance of Idealism in the Legal Profession at the American Bar Association, looking closely at ways to increase public service and pro bono work. He served as counsel and legislative director to Congressman William D. Delahunt of Massachusetts and was previously a private practice attorney with the law firm Jones Day. Mark Agras, nice to have you with us. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Jane. It's good to be with you.
So do you agree with Professor Gordon's thesis, the lawyers selling out to corporations and special interests? Is that what's happening?
Well, Bob is a wonderful scholar, and I think he has put his finger on a lot of serious problems and pressures that beset the profession today. But I think to have a fully balanced picture of what's really going on, you also have to recognize the extent to which lawyers are trying to swim against that stream. And I refer not only to lawyers in the kinds of enormous firms that Professor Gordon was talking about, but also the 83% of lawyers who still practice in other practice settings, solo, small firm, firms smaller than 50 lawyers, judges working for the courts, working for our federal and state governments and local governments. And I think many of those lawyers are facing a combination of market pressures and other professional pressures that lead, as Robert said, to some real frustrations and some real questions of balance in their personal lives and in their ability to contribute to the communities. But having said that, I think you have to also recognize how much lawyers are still doing and how many efforts are being redoubled to try to recapture that spirit of idealism, that spirit of commitment to the public good. We have lawyers around the country who are devoting literally hundreds of thousands of hours for free legal services, and I'm not talking about people who do it for a living. I'm talking about people who are practicing in these very high-pressure jobs. When the hurricanes occurred, there was an outpouring of help from all corners of the legal community, from state and local bar associations, from the ABA, where I am active.
But does it take a disaster, Mark, for that sort of action to take place? And what are the numbers really sort of in general terms as far as how many lawyers are doing pro bono work just on a day-to-day basis?
No, it actually is not the extraordinary case. I think those are merely illustrative. Day in and day out, you have lawyers contributing by serving on local councils and nonprofit boards. You have them donating services as teachers and mentors. going into the schools to talk about the Bill of Rights and the law, providing leadership to religious and civic and philanthropic organizations. You have lawyers, most of all, devoting pro bono services of a very routine kind to people who cannot afford legal services.
Professor Gordon, let me jump in here. Mark Agras is saying this is the norm, not the exception. What's your response?
Well, I think that what Mark is pointing to is very real, and that there is a good deal of pro bono work and public interest work and free representation being given the all around the country. The basic point I would like to make, though, is that as a proportion of the total contribution of lawyers' effort, this is really, really quite small. And even in firms where the most pro bono work is done, not that much is done. And I admire enormously, as Mark does, all of these efforts. For example, many big law firm partners now are representing Guantanamo detainees. It's sort of a point of prestige within those firms to have people who like this as clients, and that's great. And remember when President Kennedy asked the legal profession in 1963 to create an organ that would commit lawyers' time and efforts to civil rights. Some 200 prestigious lawyers immediately signed up to form the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights under law. And there are, as Mark suggests, there are thousands of such lawyers in such projects across the country. If you look at them, though, as a proportion of the whole of legal's effort, what you see is, I think, still that these are exceptional efforts. It's good that the ideals of the profession are still alive so that they motivate people to do that. And I know that many, many students come to law school. Many of the students I teach come to law school because they want to be part of such efforts.
Well, let me ask Mark about that.
But they're relatively marginal, I think, in the economics of the profession as a whole.
Mark Agras, do you still see an idealism among young law students today? They want to work in the nonprofit sector or be a public servant, but really, how realistic is it? They can't pay off their student loans, can't pay the bills. They're pulled in a direction maybe they never intended to go, just to get by.
Yes, I was one of those lawyers. When I started practice, I finished Yale Law School, where Bob teaches, in 1985. And I went into private practice, and I experienced many of the kinds of work-life tensions and professional frustrations with billable hour requirements that Bob described, I think, quite well. And I did leave that setting. I went to work in the public sector, where I found for myself much more satisfaction. But through my bar activities, I have also become very close to large numbers of lawyers from every state in the country, who really do take seriously the need to push back. And I think part of what we did with our Renaissance Commission many of the ongoing activities of the ABA, which devotes a lot of resources and time to this problem, are to try to come up with some solutions and to get the leaders of America's law firms to buy into those, basically to try to create a pro bono culture by setting the tone at the top of the organization so that senior managers actively encourage and participate personally in pro bono and public service activities, that they treat pro bono hours as billable. Now, we're not going to get rid of the billable hour. I think we're all realistic enough to know that for the foreseeable future, that's going to be the norm in this culture. But you can use the billable hour system for pro bono and for public service rather than against it. And those firms that have done so, there are quite a number of prominent firms around the country that have actually done this. They tend to attract a better class of young lawyer. They tend to keep them longer. They are happier. And they get a great deal of public satisfaction as well. There are a lot of things that can be done to kind of break down those barriers, and most of all, the fundamental issue, which is time. It's not a lack of inclination, but it is a lack of time.
One possible solution, we'll get to some others perhaps later in this hour. Phone lines are packed. I'd like to go to Joe from Grand Forks, North Dakota. Joe, hello. You're on the line.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I just wanted to bring up the point that it seems like the really pigeonholing all the lawyers in big firms and small firms alike.
phone lines are packed. I'd like to
so you're getting a little feedback. But, Joe, I think your call is there a difference between small firms and big firms? Robert Gordon, is it realistic to change sort of this big firm mentality to create a more balanced view of work life? And can you really do that?
Well, it's extremely difficult to do. I think because of the pressure, the pressures in that kind of practice, and I think that many people leave that kind of practice because they want a more balanced life, and they find it. Let me say though that the phenomenon I'm talking about is a little bit more than having business work life overwhelm all other kinds of commitments, like pro bono work. I'm really the lost ideal of the profession that I'm talking about is a profession that was actively involved in building the public architecture of law and legal institutions and legal procedures in the United States. That is to say, people who in their public roles weren't simply helping out though this is a very valuable thing to do, the individual vulnerable or poor clients. These were people who were helping design the basic architecture of the state, and designing it often in ways that cut against the immediate interests of some of their important corporate clients. So we have, for example, a whole progressive movement which is built around constructing a legal framework which will regulate corporations like the railroads that these people represented, which would build the both state and federal agencies which would be capable of regulating their clients, which would be capable of taming and making capitalism socially responsible. Now that sort of general architectural effort that you see among lawyers like Louis Brandeis or Charles Evans Hughes or Henry Stimson in the progressive period, and of course that you see among the great founding lawyer statesmen like Alexander Hamilton or Thomas Jefferson, you don't really see very much of that anymore. I mean, I am very pleased that in the incredibly busy lives that lawyers find time to represent the poor, the helpless, and the vulnerable. And I think this goes on at all levels of practice, including corporate practice. But again, what you don't see, I think, is this engagement with the big issues and the big structures of legal institutions. This is no longer a habitual, regular, lifetime commitment of the leaders of the bar.
Mark Agras, let me turn to you, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. This notion of building the public architecture, does that happen?
Well, it does not happen. I don't think lawyers have a monopoly on public citizenship or public statesmanship the way perhaps they once did when we look back to the earlier years of the Republic or even to the Progressive Era. But lawyers, I think if tomorrow at 2 o'clock you were to have every lawyer in a public role, whether it's an official function or something related more to our kind of civic engagement, if every one of them were to disappear tomorrow, I don't believe any of those architectural enterprises that Professor Gordon is talking about would be able to continue to function. They still play that role, even if it is not as dominant as in the past. And I think one other reason for the lack of dominance is that people in other professions have also begun to engage in the public discourse in a way that they didn't used to do. I mean, right now, the American Bar Association, under its president-elect, Bill Newcomb, is putting together a worldwide effort to link together people in other disciplines in support of the rule of law, which previously had been largely a monopoly consideration of lawyers. We realize now that we live in a world in which the professions must interconnect if they're going to be able to cope with the kind of complexities that the world now presents.
Let's get another caller on the line. Jessica from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Jessica. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane. Thanks very much for the show.
Sure.
I just wanted to call because I was actually accepted to 2 out of the top 5 law schools in the country last year. And I made what was the very difficult decision not to go because of precisely the issues that are being discussed. I was interested in practicing public interest law in the area of child advocacy. And when I looked at the realistic possibilities for me doing that, at least in the first 10 years of my career, it looked incredibly unlikely. Mm. And the personal sacrifices that I was going to have to make along the way would lead me to likely, honestly, not have the motivation after 10 years to devote myself to that area of law.
Personal sacrifices and financial sacrifices?
Personal and financial. Coming straight out of law school, directly into public interest law, even with the loan forgiveness, I would be making less money than I made before I went to undergrad, which is pretty amazing. So someone who is actually financing their legal education themselves, unfortunately, when you sit down and do the math, it's very, very untenable, even at the top schools. So,
Jessica, thank you so much for your call. Robert W. Gordon, what do you say to Jessica and others like her? How do you reach out to these young lawyers? What's your advice for them?
Well, the problem that's being pointed to is a very that Jessica's pointing to is a very real problem. There's no doubt about it. Remember, when I was leaving law school in the early 70s, starting salaries for government lawyers, for law professors, and for law firm lawyers were all more or less the same. That was, by the way, about $16,000 a year. Now the discrepancies are simply enormous. An associate starting in big law firm practice may start at a salary of $150,000 a year, and it goes up very steeply from there. So you have the obviously there are always going to be differences in the compensation between business lawyering and other kinds of lawyering, but when the business lawyers start making 10, 20, 30 times as much as other lawyers, and the other people start wondering how they're going to educate their children and how they're going to be able to buy a house, the discrepancies really become very large. Now, law schools are helping. Some law schools are helping a little bit through what Jessica called these loan forgiveness programs. That is, if you take a low salary job in the public interest law firm, for example, or a non-governmental organization, after graduation, the school that you're going to will forgive some portion or even all of your debt, depending on how much you're making. Mm-hmm. And that really helps. That does make something of a difference. But the differences in compensation over a lifetime are simply enormous.
I'm joined from Stanford, California, by Robert W. Gordon. He's a professor of legal and law history at Yale Law School. I'm also joined from Washington, D.C. by Mark Agrast. He's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Right now, I'd like to bring in one more guest, Rachel Gervich. She's a third-year law student at Harvard Law School. After taking the bar exam this summer, she plans to join a Boston law firm in the fall. Rachel, nice to have you with us.
Hi, Jane.
Has it always been your dream to be a lawyer?
I knew fairly early on that it would probably be something that I would be suited for and interested in. In fact, I remember my parents told me that when I was in kindergarten, I said I was going to open up a law firm with my brother and call it Gervich and Gervich.
to practice a specific type of law?
Well, I mean, I entered law school, and I've sort of always had public interest values, and so I have a goal of ending up doing something like civil rights litigation or providing services to indigent populations, something where I can feel like I'm actually making a difference.
You say ending up doing that. Does that mean you're going to be doing something else first?
Well, I will be joining a large law firm in the fall after I take the bar exam. And the reason for that, although I believe that the firm is doing interesting work, and I believe a lot of what has been said about the pro bono practices in law firms is very true and very valuable, is that I'm looking at $80,000 worth of debt. And I'm lucky because I didn't have any debt from undergraduate years. And I also live with my husband, who gets a small stipend from his PhD program. Other students that live on their own and have debt from undergrad may be looking at almost $200,000 worth of debt.
Hmm. Which goes to the bigger point and larger question of how to pursue public service work when these big firms, like the one you're going to, are dangling huge salaries in front of you when you have $70,000, $80,000, $100,000 in debt. What do your classmates say about that?
I think it's definitely a struggle. People A lot of people come into law school thinking they were going to do one thing and end up doing something else, at least temporarily. A lot of people do view entrance into these large law firms as sort of, you know, a kind of medicine they have to take, and then they can move on to something else. But one way that this actually plays out is that when people are choosing law firms, and I think this is indicative of something larger that some of your guests were talking about earlier, when people are choosing law firms, some of their main criteria are which have good pro bono programs, because sometimes it's hard to differentiate the firms in that there's all kinds of interesting and sort of high-level work, and so it becomes very important to see what kind of public interest work the firms are doing. And for me, that was actually one of my main criteria for picking a firm.
So do you think that's an honest assessment that they would give you about the amount of pro bono work you'd be able to do? Or once you get there, they tell you one thing and then you're on, you know, you're on working around the clock, essentially?
I think there are, you know, there are ways if you talk to current associates, if you talk to people that are just starting out in the firm and ask them what their actual pro bono practice is, I think it's a lot less dire. I know a lot of firms do count the pro bono hours as billables, and they encourage first-year associates as well as other associates to do pro bono work because they can get kinds of experience and training there that they're not immediately going to be able to get on the larger cases where they may play more of a subsidiary role.
What worries you most, Rachel, about life as a lawyer in a big firm?
The idea of having children. Basically trying to balance family with the legal career. One problem also is, I think, unique to women who are starting out in law firms, and they feel like they might, you know, if they're interested in having children down the line, they might want to go ahead and get rid of their debt before they have kids or establish themselves in the profession before they either take time off or have children while still working. So that adds another sort of dimension of complexity.
Well, let me turn to Mark Agress, because I think that's an excellent point, Rachel. Do you think, Mark, that women in the law have different choices they have to make than men? They certainly have different choices, but they juggle different things, families and children and these treacherously long hours. How do you deal with that? How does the ABA sort of recommend that firms deal with that?
Well, I very much agree with the comment, and I think you can see that reflected not so much in hiring rates out of law school, but in promotion rates within the firm and the extent to which women still do not occupy, with very few exceptions, the upper echelons of the law firm partnerships. And I think that does suggest that there is something more than mere prejudice going on, but in fact a lack of accommodation of alternative schedules and of the need to juggle different responsibilities. I think it's a species of what we've been talking about, these kinds of time pressures and lifestyle choices and pressures. One thing that I would think would be helpful also, and I can tell you about some of the changes that have been recommended to law firms, not only by the American Bar Association, but by other organizations like the Pro Bono Institute, which came up with all of the largest firms in America to do a kind of pro bono pledge and to set goals and to insist on certain standards. But law schools themselves could really be doing an awful lot about a lot of the problems that Professor Gordon has identified. First of all, they can play a much better role in trying to inculcate in young aspiring attorneys the kinds of values that will serve these goals of public service, not just pro bono, but the larger issues that that Bob was talking about with the of the lawyer as public citizen, as public architect, if you will.
Well, let me ask Rachel, who's at the Harvard Law School, are you feeling like you're getting taught those values and those virtues, Rachel?
I think that for people who are already inclined towards those things, there's a lot of great avenues to pursue them. I'm not necessarily sure that, as a matter of course, law students do get a sense of this history of the profession, of the ideal of the lawyer-statesman, or any sort of broader jurisprudential education that would sort of inform their big-picture goals. But it's certainly available for those who want it. And the other thing I think about law schools is you know, I'm looking at the Harvard website, and the estimated budget for 1 year for a Harvard law student is $62,000. $40,000 of that is tuition. So that's another way law schools don't really help the situation by, and I feel like more generous financial aid or, you know, making the education cost a little bit more sane would go sort of a long way.
Let's go back to that. Yes.
Oh, sorry.
I just want to go ahead, Mark.
We just wanted to sort of complete the thought, because I think that's exactly on target. We have a downstream problem in which law schools themselves, and sort of less Harvard and Yale, but the all of the schools that face even greater pressures from within the profession, there's a downstream problem of essentially law schools accommodating themselves to the demands that they think their students will face and the competition for their services that will arise. And I don't think they do nearly as much as they could and should to use their clout, their influence. I mean, they control the stream of future lawyers into these firms to try to not only to educate the students to want to do this work, but to also begin to insist that law firms that want to recruit on their campuses fulfill certain objectives for their students. That they're basically looking after their students once they've left the institution and left the cocoon, if you will, and go off into these firms to try to make a better environment in which they can practice, to try to exert pressure on law firms and other legal employers, for example, by using their placement offices to require firms that want to recruit to state their goal for billable hours, the number of hours that are actually contributed, the average number of hours contributed by junior associates. There's a whole you mentioned
take some responsibility for it. No, we hear your point. We hear you. I want to get to the phones because their phone lines are lit up, and a lot of people want to join this discussion. Bob is calling from Weston, Massachusetts. Bob, hello.
Yes, how are you?
Thank you, fine.
Yes, I'm a sole practitioner, always have been, and I've been doing divorce and custody trials, and I'm just appalled at the waste, bias, and abuse of good fathers in the family system. It's destructive not only to individuals and societies. And I don't know how to file a complaint, because which of my clients do I hang out for retaliation by filing that complaint while representing them zealously? I had an 11-year-old did a sit-in at a police station saying if he was going to go to his mother for custody with the usual automatic custody of mothers, he was going to go to the Boston Globe and they'd have to carry him. And it was the only thing that saved him. He was a good student, good citizen. And it goes on and on and on and on. And with the number of divorces and the number of judges, there's no way most people can ever get their case decided on the merits. It's just going to go to the mothers. That's not what the law says. It's just what judges do.
Let me ask you a broader question then. If you were to do this again, would you become a lawyer again?
Oh, absolutely not. And I have two sons. Neither one of them are a lawyer. And the other thing is I have to tell my clients, this is a paid-for justice system. How much justice can you afford? Fortunately, I was able to take many of my cases to conclusion because I'm independently supported by another business that I have. But my clients, many of them went to bankruptcy and stuff like that. But one of them, I went to the end of the trial, and the other lawyer couldn't understand why I would do that since he had no more money. And I said, well, he has 500 combat hours in a year. I'm a pilot. Maybe you don't understand that. Mm-hmm. But who has that advantage? Very few fathers ever get a fair shake, and they don't even have the money to even have their case heard on the facts. And it doesn't seem to even matter what the evidence is.
Bob, thank you for your call. We appreciate it. Steve is calling from Medford, Massachusetts. Steve, you're on the line. Hello.
Hi, Jane. Thank you.
Sure.
Look, I appreciate what Professor Gordon is doing, but I think there's a greater architecture than the legal system that has to crumble. I mean, as an example, there's a venerable firm in Boston, maybe it's the one that Rachel is going to, that puts new, inexpensive, inexperienced lawyers on a six-month rotation at legal services. But, you know, as long as the high-powered attorneys at one end of the suite are creating and reinforcing, or creating profits and reinforcing social problems, it doesn't matter how many pro bono attorneys there are at the other end of the suite. You know, good luck to Rachel, but I think she's part of the problem. It's not what they do during the six-month rotation that's significant. It's what they do after it that's significant. And that's always going to exist in this system.
Steve, thank you. Rachel, I'll let you respond to that.
I think, first of all, that there is very good work going on in law firms, more structural litigation or challenges that Professor Gordon might have been talking about earlier about the architecture of the system. So there are, he mentioned the Guantanamo cases, but there are also civil rights cases, First Amendment cases, class action cases that the big firms have the resources to pour into, that they can make a very big difference in terms of constitutional interpretation and other such things. I am a little bit hurt by being called part of the problem,
mm-hmm.
In that I don't believe that. First of all, I don't believe that going to a law firm makes you inherently a sellout. But also, I mean, I'm writing my third year paper actually on the sort of teaching of philosophy and morality in law schools. So I think I take this fairly seriously, and I just think, for a lot of people, their options are very limited, and also I don't think that equating the private sector immediately with only being for profit is necessarily true.
Thank you. Mel, you're on the air. You're on the line from Darby, Connecticut. Mel, go ahead.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Yeah, I was calling because I actually am the person who sued the American Bar Association in the state of Connecticut for the right to take the Connecticut bar exam. I actually went to a non-ABA-approved school that was approved by the state of Connecticut. I left there to help out my mother. She had some financial problems, and I ended up enrolling in a online internet law school. And after I graduated from the law school, I sued the state of Connecticut and the ABA for access to the exam, because on the state's website it made it perfectly clear that we will not accept or even review credentials from people who went to law schools that are correspondence or online related. My issue was that my education wasn't even being given an opportunity to prove that it was valid by letting me take the exam. The state never gave the argument that I was a threat to consumers because they didn't go to an ABA-approved law school. Their argument during the oral argument portion was simply that we're just not ready for this.
Mm.
And I think that people like myself who try to pursue it, pursue the study of law, even though we had had to help out family members, we have a different take on billing somebody $500 an hour. We're not going to bill somebody $500 an hour. We've been on the other side of that.
Mel, thank you. I'm running out of time, and I thank you for your call. Thank you very much. I want to turn back to Robert Gordon for a last word here. What's the solution here? You've written this article. You've talked about this a lot. You teach at the Yale Law School. What's the future?
Well, let me comment on some of the things that have been said. I think the most important thing is this problem of differential access to justice. It's true that law is very expensive. It's priced beyond the means even of middle-class people in this society. The corporate practice employs only 15% of the lawyers, but it takes about 75% of the dollars. There are tremendous the rule of law depends on everybody having equal access to the system of justice, and in our society we don't, or anything even close to it. I think actually the last caller suggested the beginnings of a possible solution, that some kinds of law practice should be deprofessionalized. There should be paralegal degrees, in which people who don't have to go through 4 years of college and 3 years of an accredited law school with all its tuition payments can help out clients who have relatively simple legal problems. Rachel, I think, is part of the solution, not part of the problem. The reason that law firms do the kind of pro bono they do is because of demands from law students like her for that kind of work. I think those demands, keeping the pressure up, has been an enormously significant factor in improving the situation. And I agree with Mark Egrass that law schools could do more to step up and intensify those demands, and also to insist on disclosure and truth in advertising from the places of work where their students are going to work. But I think that the crucial thing is that no matter how much pro bono work law firms do, they can't do work which cuts against the interests of their clientels. Mm. And there have to be opportunities and places and positions in society in which people can aspire to the kind of independence that Brandeis talked about long ago.
I'm going to let that be the last word, Robert Gordon. We're out of time. Professor of Law and Legal History at Yale Law School, his article, Money, Power, Ambition Gone Awry. Thank you for your time, Professor Gordon. And Mark Egrass, thank you for your time. We appreciate it from Washington, D.C. Thank you, sir.
My pleasure.
Rachel Gervich, good luck to you. Good luck with the bar exam. You're recently married. A bright future ahead. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks very much.
I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.